I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Earlier today, the Associated Press reported that Hillary Clinton would concede the Democratic Party presidential nomination to Barack Obama tonight if he ends this day with enough delegates and superdelegates to clinch the deal mathematically. Well, moments later, the Clinton campaign said the report of her concession was 100% not true. She will not concede tonight. Votes are still being cast today in South Dakota and Montana, the last primaries of the season. Already today, a major superdelegate, Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, cast his vote for Obama, but the Clinton campaign is obviously hoping other superdelegates will still consider her. Well, the end is in sight, so as votes are still being cast, we go back to the beginning.
In lines that stretched around schools and churches, in small towns and in big cities, you came together as Democrats, Republicans.
That's Barack Obama celebrating his win in the first contest in Iowa just 6 months ago on January 3rd. But just 5 days later, Hillary Clinton grabbed the headlines back, the second Clinton to be the comeback kid in New Hampshire.
I listened to you, and in the process, I found my own voice.
Well, our guide today over this recent history is Julian Zelitzer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. And Julian, it seems, when I say that it's only 6 months ago, that seems impossible, doesn't it?
Yeah, it seems like an eternity. This has been one long primary.
Well, of course, it goes back much further than that. Remind us, when did Obama and Clinton begin to shape change and become presidential candidates? We remember Obama's magnetic appearance at the 2004 Democratic Convention. But when did he leap, and when did she leap from talk show rumor to real thing?
I think she leapt actually during her time in the Senate. I think she really showed that she was a pretty skillful politician, and she was able to work with people who would try to impeach her husband. And I think she emerged on her own during that period, and the rumors about her presidential candidacy became quite serious. Obama's speech was obviously his first important introduction to the national scene, but I do think he didn't really take off until Iowa. I mean, he's a latecomer, and then he just skyrocketed.
Well, now there's a lot of hand-wringing, still today, over the length and the closeness of the race. As an historian, what do you say?
Well, the length was remarkable, not for how long it's lasted since January, but how early it started before January. I mean, that was the real story. Everyone thought this would be over on Super Tuesday, and so the candidates had been running for a long time, and it hurt Hillary Clinton. I think she focused all her money and attention on that, while the Obama team focused on what would happen after Super Tuesday, and that was a more winning strategy. The length of the primaries is not unusual. These usually go into the summer, or very often they go into the summer. We saw it in 1976. We saw it in 72. We saw it in 1968, where Democrats and Republicans can battle this out well into the convention.
Well, you know, you mentioned 68. So let's start there with one of the benchmarks of the last 6 months. This was one we want to review because Hillary Clinton pointed to 68 and, of course, Kennedy's assassination, Robert Kennedy's assassination, as an indication that anything can happen. Do you think it was fair that she was attacked for that? Because we essentially said the same thing in our review of the 68 Indiana primary, that it was not just Kennedy, but frontrunner Eugene McCarthy, who ultimately were not the nominees. Hubert Humphrey was.
Yeah, I mean, I think it wasn't the best statement for her to make at this point in the campaign, given all the attacks she's been going through, to focus on that as opposed to any of the other examples. That said, I don't think there's anything malicious, and I think the media blew that up more than was deserved. If you watch the whole interview, it's thoroughly uninteresting in many ways. And that is a kind of classic, late event in a primary. Kennedy's been everywhere. He's on the cover of magazines because of the memorial. So, and she said it before, no one had said anything,
right,
you know, in Time magazine. So I'm not, I think, as we've seen on both sides, often reporters kind of, went too far, I think, in trying to find gaffes and making them into defining moments.
Well, do you agree with the Clinton campaign as well when they say, what's the rush? Because some are saying the rush is to try to put John McCain back in the spotlight.
Yeah, that's true. Although, again, you know, historically, the party has been able, both parties have been able to survive primaries that go this late. And you can argue that Barack Obama has come out of this much stronger. You know, it's much better for him to get beat up by Hillary Clinton for a while and become a tougher candidate than it would have been to do this in the fall against John McCain. So in many ways, you can say this has strengthened his candidacy, not weakened it.
Well, and they're also saying that, you know, the numbers of Democrats that have registered. You know, we're looking at record numbers today in Montana, and going to vote is going to help the party ultimately.
Absolutely. Democrats have now gone through several election cycles where one of the big problems is they can't get people out to vote in the same way Republicans have. And I think, you know, nothing has been healthier than a really close and very emotional primary contest like this. So a lot of Democrats are now registered. They're following it. And they know a lot more about probably both of these Democrats than they do about John McCain. So even when you have negative press in politics, it's still good press sometimes.
Well, John McCain's making his kickoff speech in New Orleans tonight. He is, of course, the presumptive nominee. So let's stay with the timeline for the Democrats. Barack Obama wins in Iowa, remember, way back when. Clinton rebounds in New Hampshire, where she had that exchange in the coffee shop in Portsmouth the day before the primary when Marianne Pernold-Young asked Clinton how she found the energy to campaign every day. Let's listen to a little.
You know, I have so many opportunities from this country. I just don't want to see us fall backwards. No. So
it was, you know, supposed to be a teary moment. Ironically, we spoke to Marianne the next day. She voted for Obama. What did that moment say to you?
I mean, I don't know how important it was. Look, the argument is that showed her human side, that Hillary Clinton's greatest vulnerability was no one knows who she is as a person. And just seeing a little person, regardless of who it was, for some Democrats was very moving, or at least gave them an ability to sympathize with her. On the other hand, it could be seen as the same as the Bosnia remark, in that it reflected, you know, her willingness to do what's necessary to win.
Well,
so I think
later
it could play both ways.
Later she remarked that she had to dodge a sniper fire on a tarmac in Bosnia.
Right.
Video came out showing there was no sniper fire. Her backers said, look, she's touched down in thousands of places and many were dangerous and she was tired. But you say that moment was calculated and political.
Well, I don't know if it was calculated or political, but certainly many people saw it that way. I mean, for her campaign, I think that the Bosnia was one moment which really undermined her because it played into the worst stereotypes of not just her, but the Clintons. And the best moment, I think, for her came in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas, where she kind of redefined herself as this quasi-populist Democrat and started to, you know, draw very large numbers of working class, lower middle class Democrats. And I think she finally found her voice. It didn't work, but I think that was also a turning point for her.
Well, let's stay, though, with the timeline, because the next big stop would be South Carolina, where all the candidates fell over themselves going to church. And here another trajectory starts. It's the role of religion. Republican and Mormon Mitt Romney then having to explain his, moderate John McCain trying to embrace evangelicals. Obama's Reverend Jeremiah Wright. It's a well-known story by now. Obama distancing himself. Then, you know, several months later, a white Catholic priest visits Obama's home church in Chicago, this just 2 weeks ago, and makes fun of Hillary Clinton.
I'm white. I'm entitled. There's a black man stealing my show.
Obama ultimately quits his home church, the Trinity Church. McCain ultimately disavows his evangelical supporters after they make comments about Jews and Catholics. Julian, what have candidates learned here? John Kerry urged his party to embrace religion more than he did early on. But did that backfire?
Yeah, I mean, religion in politics has its underside. I mean, one of the issues is, do we want this much religion in our politics? And we've heard that in previous campaigns. And in the clips you just played, it showed the other problem that, you know, once you introduce religion, you're often tied to the religious leaders who a candidate's associated with. And I think, you know, Democrats, especially Barack Obama, has really struggled with that. I mean, Jeremiah Wright was a huge blow to his campaign, and it will remain something, you know, he has to contend with in the fall. And this last kind of comment that you just played, I think also did not, you know, play well, and to the point he's now quit the church. But, you know, this is part of, you know, you inherit the baggage of the religion that you champion. And I think he has learned that, as John McCain has.
Well, as Peter Kanellis writes in the Boston Globe today, Karl Rove, working for George Bush, you know, was masterful at using the church as leverage against the Democrats, you know, so that the Democrats would have to prove something that the Republicans already claimed in their courting of evangelicals. But that burned the Republicans this campaign as well.
Yeah, I mean, Republicans have a longer history of doing this in the recent period. They've been doing it since the 1970s, really, kind of forming an alliance with evangelicals, using them when they need to and ignoring them when they wanted to as well. But in this last campaign cycle, it's become something of a burden for them. I mean, being painted as extreme on social issues is not necessarily working well for Republicans. So I think both sides are struggling with this at this point.
Let's move from South Carolina, where the religious topic was really launched, to February, and just before Ohio, the question of experience. At that MSNBC debate, Clinton was asked a question. She said, hey, why am I always asked first? You know, her backers saying that helped Obama know the right answer. Saturday Night Live comes back from the writer's strike. They have skits about this. And then Hillary Clinton's ad in Ohio that targeted Obama for his lack of experience.
It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone in the White House and it's ringing. Something's happening in the world.
I should say the ad tried to, you know, target Obama for a lack of experience. That was its intent. How is history going to view this, you know, experience gap, if there is one?
Yeah, I think, though, I mean, the ad itself, I think, won't be as memorable as something like the Daisy ad. I don't think it was quite as dramatic. That was a 64 ad by Lyndon Johnson, which painted Barry Goldwater as an extremist. I think this was just more regular politics in the war on terrorism period. But I think the lesson with experience is it's just not enough. I mean, people don't necessarily vote for a CEO when they're voting for president. I mean, they want a character that they like, and they want someone who exhibits leadership, kind of inspirational leadership. And until that Texas, Ohio period, she didn't display that. And it really backfired on her.
But of course, her backers will say that he is less tested and can make that one misstep between now and November. Recently, he referred to a female reporter in Michigan as sweetie, and then Barack Obama left an apology on the reporter's phone. Let's listen.
That's a bad habit of mine. I do it sometimes with all kinds of people.
Julian Zelizer, that can be endearing to some, but others, it's a reminder that he doesn't have as much experience.
Absolutely. He doesn't have as much experience as a campaigner or as a politician. And I think there are many Democrats, even his supporters, who are a little nervous. I mean, he's been tested now more than before, but they know it's coming in the fall. And he can't afford to make those kind of slip-ups. And, you know, he is just going to have to be a very good freshman campaigner, basically. And he can't afford that. And then, obviously, if he wins, he's going to face immense challenges where the experience, I think, is an important factor. It's just not one that voters always move back and forth on.
That's Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. His upcoming book, Washington Warfare, it's about the politics of national security since World War II. Of course, talked to him about that down the road. But now on the last day of the primaries, this is it, June 3rd. The date that was the goalpost that kept moving back is now here. We're going to continue to look at the road that got us here with Julian in 1 minute. And a reminder later in the program, composer John Harbison, an exquisite score that he wrote over 20 years ago. It took 20 years for him to hear it in full. We'll hear that story and hear that beautiful music as well. That's later. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, also co-editor of the upcoming editor of the book Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 70s. And Julian, just briefly, the issues. Did what have we learned about how issues are treated in this past campaign?
Well, I think, you know, the one response is not very well. That, you know, overall, with all the debates, with all the coverage, we haven't had much substantive discussion of many of the big issues that are touched on by the candidates, like health care or like how do you actually revitalize an economy. So there's still not much room, even in a longer election, for substantive discussions. But we've also seen, I think, a clear interest in domestic policy that's reemerged. It's been absent for many years. But both candidates have focused mostly most of their attention on that, not on the war in Iraq. And clearly there's some kind of electoral muscle and momentum for starting to tackle issues that have just been off the radar, at least since 2001, if not earlier.
And yet when issues did come up, and all the coverage, I mean, with all the 24-hour world we live in, they still would just be in sound bites. We remember during the CNN YouTube debate in July, Obama was asked if he'd be willing to meet with the leaders of Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea in the first year of his administration. He said he would, and he said, you know, we have to start using diplomacy. That comment was later used by President Bush when he was speaking before the Israeli parliament, or the consensus was that he was speaking to Obama's appeasement. And yet at that same moment, Bush White House officials were talking with all of these countries. And we don't get that. We didn't seem to get that kind of examination.
Right. And we don't. And I do think back to our earlier discussion, Barack Obama has to be aware of that going into the fall. That is the reality of kind of modern media coverage. And, you know, if he tries to just criticize it, it won't work in his favor. He does have to work within that context. But you're right. We still haven't found, even with the Internet and even with all the 24-hour news, kind of how do you get citizens and candidates to really talk a bit about what they would do differently or what they even plan to do on the key issues of our day.
Julian, I hate to do this to you. We're going to have one more minute with you. What have we learned from the past 6 months?
I think we've learned with Democrats that there's a lot more excitement for the party than there's been in a while. Clearly, the Republicans, even with John McCain's doing well, is a party in trouble. There's not a lot of enthusiasm. There's a lot of nervousness about the party, and Republicans need to reconstitute themselves. And at the same time, Democrats still have to be careful not to blow this one. They have divisions. They have questions. And so it's going to be a kind of very heated, exciting fall campaign.
Exciting. Okay. You can choose that word. Or petrifying for many people. Julian Zelitzer of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School on this, the last day of the primary season 2008. Thanks so much for weighing in with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's the Japanese hit Hold Me with the Robot Arm. It was the wake-up call for astronauts aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery this morning as they docked at the International Space Station. Two shuttle astronauts are on a 6.5-hour spacewalk to prep the Japanese space lab Kibo for later installation onto the International Space Station, and they're going to use the space station's robot arm. Japanese astronaut Akihiko Hoshide is also on board the shuttle. Once the Kibo lab is installed, the Japanese will be entitled to more seats aboard shuttle missions. For more on today's spacewalk, we go to NPR space guru and author of Final Countdown, NASA, and the End of the Space Shuttle Program, Pat Duggins. Pat, exactly what are these astronauts doing during the space rock?
Well, they've got a pretty full list of things to do today, Robin. Number one, as you mentioned with the earlier song, they're going to be preparing the Japanese experiment module, nicknamed Kibo, to be hoisted out of the shuttle's cargo bay. But on a more personal note for the astronauts, you'll recall that after every mission following Columbia, they used to take this long 50-foot-long boom and grab the end of it with the shuttle's robot arm and scan their tiles for damage. Well, the Kibo lab is so big in Discovery's cargo bay, there wasn't room for a boom, so the astronauts had to come up without one. So what the previous shuttle crew did was they left their boom on the space station. So now this crew is going to grab that old boom and scan their tiles that way. Now, the only problem for NASA is that this is the longest that one of these boom contraptions has been up in space. They think it'll work fine, but the acid test will be when they start doing the scanning.
Well, and it's important because we understand the Discovery launch also caused the largest damage to the launch pad in nearly 3 decades.
Everyone, including NASA, was just amazed by the amount of bricks and mortar and stuff that had just been torn away from the launch pad, because this is the same flame trench they used for the Apollo missions back in the 1960s. NASA just kept it in place and modified it for use for the shuttle, and the damage was pretty severe. So number one, NASA wants to make sure there was no damage done to Discovery, but also down the road, they've got an October mission to send astronauts to fix the Hubble Space Telescope, and they don't know if they're going to be able to use that launch pad or not.
So a lot of repair work going on. Well, this Kibo, which, you know, displaced the boom in coming up, must be important. It's a billion-dollar science lab. What are astronauts going to be able to do once it's installed?
Experiments as far as communication, biotechnology, all sorts of things. In fact, it's going to be just the Kibo lab itself in Discovery's payload bay is the biggest research facility on board the International Space Station. And if you think about it, the Kibo complex, the whole thing, is three parts in one. It took three shuttle missions to get all this stuff up into space. So by the time it's done, it will easily be the largest research facility on the International Space Station. And some members of the Japanese Space Agency have been waiting 25 years for this to go up. So for the Japanese people, it's a big triumph.
Okay, one last question we have to ask you before we let you go, Pat. The fact that the Discovery Shuttle has arrived with all of this technology also means perhaps that they've come with something to fix the toilet with?
Oh, you had to ask that, didn't you? My goodness gracious. What the heck? No, actually, they do. They've got a Russian-made pump that weighs about 30 pounds, and they've got a bunch of hoses, and they're going to basically turn that over to the two cosmonaut crew members on the International Space Station because it's a Russian-made toilet, and they're the ones who are trained to fix it. And I'm sure it's going to be a big relief for the crew because, quite frankly, it's been like a week since that contraption stopped working on orbit, and they've had to resort to everything from, like, three flushes and it doesn't work anymore to, quite frankly, plastic bags.
Pat Duggins, who covers all things space for NPR, also author of Final Countdown, NASA, and the End of the Space Shuttle Program. Thanks for speaking to us today.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Okay, some stories in the works here at Here and Now. Maury Sendak of Where the Wild Things Are. He turns 80. He has a new exhibit in Philadelphia. Also, he has some old demons from his childhood, as we'll learn. And the alleged mastermind of the September 11th attacks will face a military tribunal on Thursday in Guantanamo Bay. We'll have a preview. That's in the days ahead. But still ahead today, a 5-year-old Iraqi boy comes to the U.S. to receive medical care. How does he make sense of his injuries at the hands of Americans? That's after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
You want to make wings?
Omar Mahmoud stands a few inches under 4 feet tall. Like many other 5-year-olds, he likes to eat ice cream, play computer games, and carry around his favorite toy, his beige plastic horse. Do not put a Barbie sticker on his horse.
I didn't put a Barbie
sticker. Well, no, I'm so sorry. Somebody put a Barbie sticker. Sorry.
This is Ali.
Omar's father, Saba, shows us pictures of Omar's brother, Ali, and the rest of the family when they lived together in Iraq.
My wife.
Oh, she's beautiful. But in 2006, the family was traveling from their home in Mosul to Baghdad when, for some still unknown reason, U.S. soldiers fired on their van. Omar's brother, Ali, was spared, but his father, Saba, was shot. And when the van burst into flames, Saba's wife, Omar's mother, was killed, and Omar horribly burned. Omar received care at a U.S. military hospital, then an Iraqi hospital, but he was still terribly disfigured when he was discharged. Enter Cole Miller, founder of an American organization called No More Victims.
I focus on children who are harmed as a result of U.S. military assault because I think that's where my most direct responsibility lies.
Cole brought Omar and Saba to Children's Hospital here in Boston, where doctors have donated their time to perform a number of surgeries on the little boy. Now Omar and his dad literally live here. A volunteer, Dr. Robert Morris, takes Omar to school and Saba to English classes and a local mosque, helps Omar navigate this bewildering new world as an Iraqi and a burn victim. There was the time Omar went to a party.
And he had a bad incident there. Just a young fellow, same age, staring and staring and staring and finally saying, I don't like you. I don't like the way you look. And he came away. He didn't cry or anything else. He just came and went to my wife and said, someone said something bad. So she knows how to handle it, and she calms him down, and he moves on.
We visited Omar and his dad at the patient family home at Children's with the help of an interpreter, a Kuwaiti student from MIT, Abdul Aziz.
Well, we're so sorry for your loss. The loss of your wife.
Thank you.
Sometimes he thinks, well, I may not be able to find someone like even near what she was as a wife to me, so he doesn't know how he can deal with that. So he says life is difficult, but, you know, life is life.
Since
a while ago, a TV channel or a newspaper, they asked him how Omar was, and he's like, well, Omar sometimes tells me, well, Dad, why don't you just go buy us some other here? They must be available somewhere. He's like, well, you know, if there was one I could buy, I would buy it for you, but, you know, I can't just buy you another mother.
How must your feelings be? The same people who attacked the car you were in are helping you.
This is what God has written for us, and if this is fate, then this is fate.
Were you afraid to come here?
No.
He's never expected that this would happen. He just dreamed of actually getting to America.
Because you needed help, yeah, because of the problems that you had. You needed the medical help. What does Omar think happened?
They know everything. He thinks they're kids, but they're not, because they tell him, look, Dad, we know everything that happened. We know that, you know, you got shot, you left the car. We know that our mom died in the accident. They're very aware of the situation.
How hard is it for you to be separated from Ali, who's back near home, and to be here with one child, to be, you know, it's, you're so far from home?
There's not a person in the world who does not miss his home or does not long to go back home, but the people in his family see what's happening every day and the deaths that are happening and just tell him, just don't come back, it's not worth it. He doesn't really know what to do, and he's just going to stay here now until everything is okay and then make a decision.
Omar's now moved on to the horses on the computer.
You love horses.
What have you seen happen for Omar here?
He's learned English, his interactions with people are better, he's learned a bit of French along with some other subjects, and Omar's dad also goes downtown for school.
Learning English.
Yeah.
How do you, I mean, physically, you and Omar are getting medical help and attention and you're getting repaired physically, but how do you repair emotionally? I mean, that day must have been just horrible.
He says that something like this is extremely difficult to repair. He says there's another Egyptian family here with them in the hospital, and Omar sees them sometimes, and he asks his dad, how come, you know, he cries. He's like, how come they have a mother and a father, and I only have a father and I don't have a mother? And he says that he's talked to a psychological doctor over at the children's hospital, and he's told him, well, how can we help out with the whole situation? And here his response was, well, can you replace, you know, this child's mother?
Hmm. What do you do with those feelings of anger, loss?
It's his personality. He's very social. When people ask him where from in Iraq he is, he tells them, and they're like, no, they don't believe him. They're in disbelief. It's a very dangerous area. There's a lot of crime there, and you're such a peaceful, nice guy. How does that work out? And he says, well, you know, that's just how I am.
With the assistance provided in the country, I connect the kids with the child in Iraq.
Remember Cole Miller with No More Victims? He says, like Saba, most Iraqis he brings to the U.S. are forgiving.
And they come here a lot of times with great trepidation because they know they're coming to the country from which the soldiers came, who caused the damage. But when they come here, they're uniformly shocked by how kind and considerate and generous and concerned people here are.
Omar's treatment is stretching on for months more than anticipated. He's already been in the U.S. for more than a year. Dr. Brian LeBeau says speed is a secondary concern.
It's very difficult to sort of have 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 operations in a year. That's a lot of surgery, and certainly a lot of surgery in someone who's already had a year's worth of surgery and been through war trauma, and also someone who is 5 or 6 years old in a foreign country. You want to get everything done quickly, but there's more to it than simply just getting it done as quickly as possible.
So Sabah and his son Omar will stay in the U.S. for a while longer. What have you noticed about America that's different?
He feels like the life here is very strenuous. You have to have 2 jobs at the same time, and everyone's always busy, and everyone's always, you know, in a rush to go somewhere. So he feels like he can't keep up with everything that's happening.
And glancing over at me and producer Jill Ryan, part of a steady stream of female workers and volunteers he's met, Sabah had one last observation.
It's interesting how the women here work a lot and are very, like, active in daily life and in community life. He's very surprised and impressed at how you guys are, like, everywhere all the time.
We're everywhere. You are.
Different in Arabic.
It's different in Iraq.
A lot of them have a good heart here, a lot of the American women.
That's Sabah Mahmoud speaking through an interpreter about his new life in the U.S. Again, he and his son Omar live in the patient family home at Children's Hospital Boston, where Omar is being treated for war-related burns. Doctors at Children's Hospital Boston have donated their time to care for Omar. The Raytime Medical Aid Foundation is helping to cover the hospital's costs. The group No More Victims brought Omar from Iraq to the U.S. For more information, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And before we go today, a journey of a different sort. Composer John Harbison has written a soundtrack for Homer's Odyssey. Will it ever become the ballet he intended? You're listening to Here and Now. John Harbison is one of the most applauded of contemporary composers. He's won a Pulitzer and a MacArthur Genius Grant. He's composed music for the Pope and written the score for a full-length ballet he proposes based on the journey of the Greek hero Odysseus, or Ulysses to give him his Roman name, as he makes his 10-year journey home to Ithaca after the Trojan War. Ulysses, slaying monsters, overcoming the wail of the sirens and the spell of the enchantress Circe, to finally arrive and free the waiting Penelope from the suitors who hold her captive in his home. But Harbison's Ulysses was written in 1983. The ballet was never choreographed, and the music wasn't performed in its entirety until 20 years later, when the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, under the baton of founder Gil Rose, took it on. BMOP has now released their recording of Ulysses on a new CD, and joining us in the studio is composer John Harbison. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you say in the liner notes to this CD that this was your chance in this performance in 2003, was it?
And, yes, I believe, yes.
Yep, and recording, to actually hear this in its entirety?
That's the first time, yes, that the whole piece was ever played.
What's that like? I mean, for a classical composer who depends on the orchestra to really bring their music to life, what is that like to hear it for the first time?
Well, it was very interesting. Of course, you know, Ulysses took 10 years to complete the journey, so I thought 20 to hear the piece was really okay. I'd heard it in sections, but to hear it end to end was a completely different experience, and really some ways quite surprising to me. There also was the chance in the performance to project titles on the wall, which were telling the audience what scene was on and giving a certain location in the story, which I thought was helpful.
And what was surprising about it to hear it?
Well, I'd heard a lot of my other orchestra pieces in the meantime, and I guess surprising to me, because of course I'm closely focused on whatever I'm doing, is how different the thinking about the orchestra was in this piece from some of the things I'd done subsequently.
How so?
Well, I tend to work, I guess, in a less kind of cinematic idiom than then.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I was a little surprised that people said about the piece at the time, but I think it was quite accurate, was that the music seemed very depictive of the scenes. That is to say, it definitely was the kind of music that we associate with both scene dramas and operatic drama. Of course, when I wrote the piece, I'd hoped it would be performed as a full-length ballet. Nobody told me that no one was doing full-length ballets of virtually any kind at the time.
Right.
A ballet, to get any reasonable number of, or even a single performance, with a very large orchestra like this, is also a real white elephant. So I came out of my little cocoon there and looked around, and it was certainly about as impractical a piece as one could think of. And hearing the music in shorter segments, I guess I never got the sense of how cumulatively it would come across. That was really only evident at the end of Gil's first performance. But I also was fairly happy with the way that came out. The goal shouldn't be reached all that easily in the story of Ulysses.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Composer John Harbison's score for his proposed ballet, Ulysses, had a journey almost as long as its heroes, 20 years between when it was first composed and when it was performed in full by Gil Rose and the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, or BMOP. As Harbison said, no one told him how difficult it is to stage a full ballet or score one with a full orchestra, thankfully, because he might have quit. Instead, we have this lovely composition waiting for a ballet company to dance. It. John Harbison, let's listen. As Ulysses begins his journey home from war in Troy to his beloved Penelope in Ithaca. You're nodding.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it's, well, yeah, that's what I meant.
It is the theme of the journey, and of course, the goal of the journey, which he thinks is Penelope.
To get home, yeah.
Right, to get home. Of course, it turns out it's not exactly that, because it's also this kind of discovery and a sense of adventure takes him over at certain points, and also he is diverted. He is waylaid. Literally.
I'll say.
So as the piece goes on, this theme keeps coming back, reminding, I guess, Ulysses of the journey, but is woven into these sojourns.
And boy, does he get waylaid, as you said. The sailors find a monster. And that said to you, tuba?
Yeah, well, I was actually a tuba player in high school, and I always thought of the instrument as a friendly monster. In the case of the story, the monster's not so friendly. Mm-hmm. But Polyphemus is kind of represented in the first scene by the tuba, and he's both comic and scary. At least that's the idea.
Right. Then they find the leather bag with winds that were put there by the god Aeolus. He communicates with the dead in the land of the shades. Why this story? I read in the liner notes that you were inspired by an opera.
I was inspired by an opera because there was one scene in Monteverdi's Return of Ulysses, the stringing of the bow, which struck me as just as movement, one of the most wonderfully expressive scenes I'd ever seen. I thought, what about that as the kind of downbeat, the goal point of a ballet?
This is when he, Ulysses, or Odysseus, finally gets back to Ithaca. He finds that Penelope is sort of held captive in their home by all of these suitors who, you know, well, the cat's away, they're trying to play. And so he dresses, he disguises himself as a beggar and is stringing his bow to fight for her, to win her back in a dramatic finale. Mm-hmm.
His bow has been left behind, and the whole test is, could any of these suitors string it? And I thought the scene of the suitors failing.
Yeah, they're trying to string the bow.
They try, and they just can't get there. And, of course, then he, in disguise, with a kind of pre-theme that sort of leads us, I think, to understand what this is going to mean, not only strings the bow, but starts the fight and basically demolishes the suitors. This is his sort of a moment of taking back his kingdom. One of the things that I loved about the scene is that just before all this happens, Penelope makes kind of an entrance, and there's a moment of sort of gentleness or tranquility or at least a moment of waiting. Then really all hell breaks loose, as it were. Once he strings the bow, he is in a warlike posture. And it struck me as being a valuable problem in a way for me to see whether I could hold a long span, which is almost an hour of music up to that point, and then let down. It's really associated really with the trumpet, the stringing of the bow. The trumpet becomes the carrier of that news, and would it feel like a kind of a reward? Because again, that's the whole idea of the story, that he experiences all this, he learns things, but really it turns out that what he really did want is what he thought he wanted.
John Harbison, do you think this is ever going to be performed as a ballet, or will it only be in your head?
Well, at this point, you know, it's been a long time. I'm not quite sure how much it matters whether it's performed or not. Actually hearing the piece end to end has certainly done a lot for my feeling a kind of closure about the piece. It would be, I think, really fun to see if these characters, when danced, could actually feel these rhythms as appropriate to the story. That would be, as a composer for the stage, which, you know, I also have written opera, that interests me more than just the simple fact of, is it ever out there for the public?
Well, meanwhile, music critic Richard Dyer writes in the liner notes that Ulysses was the sleeping beauty among Harbison's major works, and when it was performed, it awoke full of life. And it occurs to me that now that it's on CD, you really did create the ballet. I mean, because it's in my head, too.
Yeah, and it's in mine, and that's what I mean by it not being so important. Also, you know, the way that we imagine things, I'm sorry to say, or maybe happy to say, is often more happy-making, more satisfying to us than what actually happens. Mm-hmm. I've found that to be true in the Opera House, too, that it's so hard to get something on stage that is really close to what the person that makes it imagines. The scene in the underworld, which is, I think, a scene in the story, which is so powerful, where he goes down and he sees all these heroes and talks to them and so forth. And finally, there's this very, very melancholy ending to the scene where he really realizes how far, in a way, he strayed from the path. That scene, I would love to see dancers in it, but I've had such a vivid imagination of what they look like. I'm not sure it would be better.
That's composer John Harbison. His ballet Ulysses has been recorded by the Boston Modern Orchestra Project. It's now available on CD, so you can create the dance in your own head as well. John Harbison, thanks so much for coming to talk to us about it.
You're very welcome.